all of the projects doing the other people writing. So usually if you think it's worked and you didn't run the program, most of the cases it doesn't work. Because you forget really stupid things.
That's my experience too. We, in our company, I've jokingly said we have to print ourselves a banner code without test is broken and hang it somewhere, because you find it's true again and again and again, and you can like tell hundreds of anecdotes that all come back to the fact that if it doesn't have tests, it's broken.
Yeah. I think the challenge I sometimes get to this is that people say, well, you know, we've hinted at Laurie and some comments last night about legacy code. Is that, well, you know, we all bitch about legacy code, but the fact is there's 100,000 running in production. I think that's fair, but, you know, having users use live software is another form of test. So, you know, it's not that we need to narrow that around sort of, you know, whether unit tested code, but the point is that yes, it's only once we critique our software that we realize that it's now this section is just a little bit of terminology that I think is helpful. I have to give credit where it's due. This comes from the ISTQB certification syllabus. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that, if we're not pretty well known amongst the modern community. Does anyone here sort of know ISTQB and what that means? Okay, is it common amongst your colleagues or yourself?
In Germany, it's quite common. Yeah, it means international software testing and qualification.
Oh, Yeah. The time that I see that's right. It's an international board that's created this syllabus that's supposed to be like has various courses and examinations for certifying testers. It's enormously common across the testing community. So anyone who's been in testing sort of ends up coming across it at one stage or another. And it divides opinion. My opinion's fairly clear. It's not something I particularly recommend. I did it many, many years ago, and most of it I've forgotten. It was some pretty wasted time. There are a small amount of things that I do remember from that course, and of that, most of it is pretty good. But yeah, there's so one or two small nuggets in there, and that's what I'm sharing with you now. And it's about being clear about our terminology that is often sort of intermixed or often sort of misused when trying to describe things like software defects and so forth. And interestingly, this little, you know, set of terms doesn't include the word defect at all, which is probably useful because it means it avoids some of the baggage that comes with that. But the point is that it says that there is a sequence of events that occurs when software problems arise. And the first is that a person, a human being, does something, they make a mistake. So this is very much about recognizing that it's faced with choices within our process. Somebody has made a choice or taken an action that they shouldn't have done. Generally, we don't realize that at the time. That's really the main point about this, is that the root cause, the root mistake that was made, is usually separated quite some distance in time before our discovery. But the nature of the mistake might be one has interpreted a document incorrectly, one might have failed to add a particular bit of detail to some instruction, you might have not held the conversation that you were supposed to, you might not have attended a discussion that you needed to. Whatever the mistake is, it's about something that some person did wrong. Through what may be a chain of events that leads at some point to a fault existing in our software. And that's an objective thing that exists. It's not necessarily observed at that time, but that fault is there. But we will only realize that or discover that fault when that fault is manifest, when it's discovered as, or it's evidenced as a failure when the system is used. Now, usage, of course, could apply to an automated test of some kind, or it could be a real user attempting to use this in live use. Whatever it is, there is, you know, our software is being exercised, and we get a failure. We get a difference between what should have happened and what actually happened. That difference is the error. So the correct use of error is not that the failure occurs. The correct use of error is how much did it differ from what it should have. So we're used to, you know, if we're talking purely functional type issues, we're used to it being this being a sort of a binary, a black and white thing here. It should have done something, it did something different. Now, there are many classes of errors that are more point on a scale. So if we think of, say, performance testing, it's not really a case of, you know, it should have responded in 5 milliseconds and it responded in 6. It's, you know, we have some tolerance for what we believe is acceptable, and it's only when our difference goes outside that tolerance that we say, right, this is a failure condition, we're going to need to remedy it. So it's important to remember that yes, it's not every difference between expectation and actual behavior represents something that needs to be fixed, because sometimes it might be within our explicit or implicit marginal error. So there you go, you don't need to get an ISTQB certification, you now know the only useful good bit in there. Let's turn back to some things on the other side of the coin. Things developers can help to test it for them. We talked about defects and how those are created. The important thing is that when we do identify a defect, or when we report a defect, what we're really doing is expressing an opinion. And again, I think some testers sort of place too much preemptive value on defect reports without sort of realizing what they're doing, is saying, this is an observation. I see something that I believe to be outside the margin of error or different to what an expectation should be. I think I've got evidence of a fault in the system. But really, that's just, you know, somebody putting something forward that the team or the stakeholder on this project needs to be able to act upon. So, if a stakeholder sees the evidence of this defect, if they understand the difference between what they believe the expectation was and what the actual value was, and they choose to decide, we can live with that, we don't think the cost of that is a really time investment, then we can choose to leave it. So the point is that the defect is really a placeholder for making a decision for what we need to do. The other part, the sort of corollary to this, is that a defect in the sense of assuming that we have a good test-driven context, i.e. a normal mode of operation is to say, before we do any work, we're going to understand whether the test case that we've proven we've done it right, hoping that's sort of normal practice for everyone in the room. If we then still find a defect in spite of all our preemptive tests passing, then that's told us there's a test that we missed, at least one. The simple process, therefore, and I hope I'm not teaching people to suck heads, maybe you're already doing this, is that, okay, if we do have a defect report that's outside of any existing test phase, so we're assuming that all our TDD tests are passing, somebody finds a defect, and our stakeholder says, yes, I confirm this is a problem, we do need to fix this, then the next thing that we do is to work out what behavior should have occurred. But that's the other problem with many defects. It depends on what approach the person reporting the defect is doing it. Often a defect will simply say, this was the observed behavior, and my opinion is that behavior is wrong, but they won't necessarily state what the behavior should have been. Often that's implied, that's why we identify it as a defect, but a defect report often doesn't state what should have occurred. the best ones do. In any case, that's really something that's up to the team, or at least the product owner, to be clear about what is the required behavior. Given this defect, what should have occurred instead of what did occur. That gives you enough information to have a brand new test. That's why I think a test is a better asset than a defect report. The test tells us what the expected behavior should be, and the state of that test failing is the proof that we've got a defect. So we run new failing tests and assert the behavior that's therefore expressed in the defect. That test will pass when our defect is fixed. So that means we've now got something that serves the purpose of being the identification of the existing problem, and it will be, once that problem is fixed, it will be an ongoing regression test to make sure that defect doesn't return. So I like defects to be, defect reports that is, to be treated in this way. They are temporary placeholders that get us to an improved test suite. Can I ask, who's sort of doing that? For whom is that sort of normal practice? Do you recognize this particular pattern that you say you're doing this? Is it something that your testers are comfortable with? Do you and then QA people in your organizations still wed into the idea of defects as being something separate from the automated tests?
Well, it depends on the kind of defect that you're talking about. Because for some products we don't have tests which are mainly on the UI layer, so if it's a bug in the UI layer, like, what do I know, CSS class wrong or something like that, then there will probably be no automated test for that. So it depends a bit where the test, the defect is coming from. Mm-hmm. If it's something in the business logic or data access layer, then there's probably a test for it. If it's in the UI layer, possibly there's no test for it.
Okay, and one other point to make here, again, it's hopefully it's not particularly common these days, but in some organizations they'll still be, in response to a test failure, someone will raise a defect report. That strikes me as incredibly wasteful. If the results of the tests are something that the team pays attention to and acts upon quickly, then there's no need to raise a separate defect on these. In the test itself, failure of that test, it should be self-evident what is we need to correct from that. There's also the sense that, again, I sometimes hear testers who are talking about, they feel that unit test-driven development, for example, is insufficient because it doesn't do end-to-end testing. Generally agree with that principle, but I don't like the opposite position, which says the way we ought to be testing is to always test end to end. I think it seems to emphasize the wrong thing, which is that the most important thing is that we've got coverage from one start of a workflow or a long process through to the other. I think that's okay for saying, do we have some evidence that all our components that might be separately tested, are they connected in a sensible way? But the problem here is that if all your tests are very large end-to-end tests and you get a failure, well, how useful is that information to you? So I think the value of tests comes from not only what they tell us, but how useful are they at understanding what we need to do next in terms of what action should we take. As soon as you have a broad test where something went wrong somewhere in that end-to-end process, you don't have, it's going to take you a long time to diagnose and decide what is the action that you need to take here. And,
I've got a point to that because I'm just thinking about examples in my work where the bug happens in some kind of, well, it's not really an interaction between components, it's really ominous where the bug happens. It's, I don't know if you have time for a diversion. It's about there's a security system in place. So model objects have security declarations, or, and that's mostly the bug, they don't. And then if you try to access the function through the UI, because then you are logged in, then it will work. But while you're just testing the model itself, you won't have any security because who cares? So then a very common bug is, okay, I did everything, I got my model right, I got the test right, and then I forgot to add the security declaration, so if the user clicks on the button, nothing happens, it goes boom, because, Now I'm just wondering. Of course, I do think end-to-end testing is not such a hot idea, but what do I do? It seems quite pointless to write tests that say, I need a security declaration for that and that model, because that's like just writing on the same thing twice and won't help me not forget it. So what we do is then, okay, then we just shrug and say, okay, so I write an end-to-end test that says the user can use that feature, and then I'm sure I made the declaration, but it strikes me as odd. I don't know if anyone has common in that.
And sometimes with some frameworks we have the way you have to test the configuration.
Something like that.
Yeah, for instance with Spring. So sometimes all unit tests run on the testing machine, but we have a slightly different configuration on the production machine, so we have tests for the configuration to make sure that some things are the difference has to be tested, because otherwise it might produce a failure on the production system. But I think that you need at least one end-to-end test. You don't need end-to-end test for every feature, but at least one or a couple, a few, to see if everything to put together works.
And that's where, yes, I want to be clear about this. I totally agree one needs those tests. One should be careful, however, to sort of assume that that's the safe way to test, and therefore you start to introduce all sorts of combinations in there in the belief that you know, I haven't really proven anything unless I've proven it end to end. I guess a simple way to do this is think of your test as being a camera lens. Now you can either zoom in or you can zoom out. That's fine, but you know, as you zoom out, you lose detail. Mm-hmm. As you zoom in, you lose scope. So it's fine. I think a test should have a consistent error.
In the best case, you do something like
exactly. In order to understand,
you do end-to-end tests that just say, okay, that's the happy path, it works, and then you do the detailed ones that say, and these are all other conditions that might happen, and might tick them off or something.
Exactly. Elizabeth Hendrickson had that nice, I think that came up as a tweet that sort of pointed out the diagnosis part. This is one thing to, yes, if hot water comes out of our shower head, that's a good proof that all of the bits in the process are working as far as I'm concerned for this usage scenario. But as soon as the water isn't coming out, as it failed to do in the channel this morning, that end-to-end test is not a good way of understanding where does the problem lie. Okay, so let's move back to things tested to help developers now. Who's doing acceptance tests within development as the normal way of working on the situation? Okay, only one, that surprised me. And who's considerate but doesn't do it because there's been a conscious decision to say we would or wouldn't do this? Has anyone sort of contemplated acceptance tests within development as a normal process and decided, no, that's not for us?
We're going to turn it down to fuzzy on what that means.
Okay, so in addition to unit test driven process where developers are designing their own unit tests and they're running their code, at a feature level or story level more commonly, we say, how do we know the story is done? Let's express those as some acceptance tests. We automate those prior to implementing functionality such that once those are passing, that's out.
Oh yeah, we do that. Okay. That's what it has to mean.
Exactly. Well, if that's just normal software development, that's kind of the direction I was expecting. For some organizations that balk at this, you know, because I spend encounter a lot of organizations that are asking how to improve their process. Usually it's one of the first things that I query them on. Once that is explained, that you know, we're doing most of that acceptance test activity as a front-loaded thing, that we are therefore need developers to sort of understand what are the test questions being asked, they need to automate those, the back and forth and so forth. There's usually a complaint that that's going to slow us down. Clearly, if developers are spending time on this this work, they're going to have less time working production code, it's going to slow us down, but that velocity will get hit. I think that's a trickier way to look at the problem, because yes, it does slow it down, but only in a way that is like saying that my bus is going to be slowed down by stopping to pick up passengers. So it's not, to be honest, it's not so much developers that see this problem. I find it's rather more managers. It's managers who are measuring the productivity of their teams by how well utilized developers are and what they believe to be the thing that developers should be doing most. And I think that's the source of the problem, is that when we have, especially when we have organizations where sort of management of development resources separated from management of testing resource, that really does cause this problem particularly badly. Because there's no one person who's responsible for saying, well, the thing that's valuable here is passing tests, right? It's working testing software coming out of this team. And that's really about passenger journeys. That's the thing that the bus is here for. That's our purpose. Utilization of the bus, the speed of the bus is completely irrelevant if it's at the expense of completing passenger journeys. This point is about the fact that it's related to the issue of testing being an infinite or open-ended activity, is that the amount of testing that we do, clearly we could carry on forever if we were trying to be exhaustive. Therefore, it sort of poses the question, well, what is worth testing for? How much time is it worth spending exploring something that's been built before we're able to say we're satisfied with the testing? And this comes from the sort of analogy, or this phrasing comes from the fact that when I was quite young, my father was very into alternative fuels. So long before we were concerned about CO2 emissions and so forth, he would say, we've got to do something about reducing our dependence on oil, because you know that's fossil fuels are a limited supply, we're going to run out, and then what are we going to do? We need some other way to create energy. So he was big into research on renewable energy sources and so forth. And I remember quite distinctly him saying to me, this was probably 1970-ish, he said, there's only 30 years left of oil. And I said, wow, that's good for a kid. The first reaction is, that's ages away, that's an impossibly big number. But over time I started to think, oh my God, the clock is ticking on this, and we're driving around more and more cars. And of course, it was now past 2000, and I asked my brother-in-law, who was also in the oil exploration industry, and I said, how much oil is there left? Because I remember all these predictions that said the oil should have run out by now. He said, oh, yeah, there's probably about 30 years left. And I said, well, how does that work? This wasn't like the prediction 30 years ago. He said, well, the way to look at it is this. It's not like the oil is in a great big tank with a tap on the bottom and you just go and help yourself. It costs to get the oil out of the ground. So all of the expectations, all of the predictions about how much oil is left is based on the assumption of what is it worth extracting? Because there's the oil that's cheaper to extract, and there's other oil that's much more expensive to extract. It's deeper, there's smaller fields, harder terrain, and so forth. So there's a cost associated with getting the oil out. The actual prediction of roughly how much there is in the world, I think, has been fairly consistent over that time. All the models have that to within the right sort of order of magnitude. The thing that has changed is, what is it worth to us, and what is it going to cost to get out? Now, if the costs, they come down slightly as technology increases, but what has been the big difference is the value of the oil. So when the oil was only worth $5 a barrel, everyone said, let's work out how much of this oil we can extract for less than $5 a barrel, such that we can sell it at a profit. Now, when oil is now $100 a barrel, that opens up a completely different equation on what's worth extracting. You spend $50 a barrel finding the thing out, you still make a tidy profit on. And that's why these sort of calculations about how much oil is left has changed over time. It's because the work, what we value, what we're looking for, has gone drastically higher. Of course, you know, it's not an open-ended thing. It's never going to be 30 years. It's not going to be 30 years forever. But yeah, that's being the account of that. So there's a similar thing here going on with testing. How much value we put on the tests will determine how much it's worth investing our time and effort into making good tests. So some people will say to me, well, you know, should I really be putting this detail? Should I really be you know, concerned about this much coverage? My answer to that is always, well, you know, who does this help? Who gets value out of these tests? And if your tests are limited to a small group of people who pay attention to it, then probably you're not going to invest a whole lot of time in that because the test is not seen as valuable. Once you can make your tests an asset the whole team values, then you change your economics about how much time you spend on making them better or getting better coverage. So I think the key to getting more time, if you like, or to invest in tests is making them more valid in the first place. Find out how you can get better use out of the tests you have. Can they serve as long-term living documentation? Can you express your tests in such a way that the things you write don't just check something the first time, but represent a nice, you know, accessible representation of this is what the system does, and this is checked for correctness every night. Once you get to that point, then some of your business people will say, this is specifications, this is documentation, these are not just test cases. When you get to that point, then being able to say, it's worth us spending the time designing this test correctly, you'll start to have better conversations with people like that. Another point here is that when we talk about test coverage, there's often a lot of confusion about what we mean by that. And things like statement coverage is fairly easily done because it can be, there's all sorts of tools that will do that. Testers tend to talk about requirements coverage, and I think that's the normal measure of test coverage. The fact is, all forms of test coverage refer to models. The thing to note here is that the key is in the name, the model is not the real thing. So the lines of code that we are executing are not a system that human beings interact with. A set of requirements or a backlog of story cards are not a software system that human beings interact with. They're both ways of representing what that system is, but they aren't the real system. So whenever we talk about how good our test coverage is, we're only saying, I've covered this much of the model. So the next question to ask is, well, how useful is your model? What does that really represent? How detailed is it, and how much coverage have you got? So there's a simple trade-off here. Yes, it is possible to have complete coverage of the model. One can have 100% statement coverage, but your model is never complete. And the more complete your model, the less it's economic to try and get complete coverage of. What I like to say is, I can prove that I've seen the whole world, because the world, of course, is comprised of exactly two hemispheres, the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere. I'm Australian, so I've done the Southern Hemisphere. I'm now in Germany, so I've done the Northern Hemisphere. So I have 100% hemisphere coverage of the world. Okay. That's the way to sort of get people away from these ideas that of course we can have complete coverage because we can have 100% statement coverage. Statement coverage is one thing, and then you have branch coverage, condition coverage, you have modified condition, decision coverage, and those all stack up to much, much bigger models that it's harder and harder to get 100% coverage of. That every model falls victim to this problem. It's just a representation. Okay, well, that was six things that developers can help testers learn. That was six things that testers can help developers learn. I'm going to close with just a couple of things that I think are worth everybody in the software craft can learn. My kids are into Pixar films. If you've seen Finding Nemo, you'll recognize this phrase where they say fish are food, friends not food. Well, testers are friends, not food. Some organizations tend to treat them differently. Why are they friends? Well, firstly, there are of course degrees of friends. There are, you know, friends and there are best friends. And your friend will help you move a couch, and your best friend will help you remove a dead body. And at the other end of the scale, there are Facebook friends. Why do I say testers are friends? Well, imagine it's because testing, and I hope this is reflected in the answer that you gave to me earlier. You know, testing is not who I am; it's what I do. And it's like saying, imagine someone on your team came up to you and said, I could really do with a tester to help me solve this problem. You could feel justified in saying, I'm a developer, not a tester. But if the same person came up to you and said, I could really do with a friend to help me solve this problem, well, you're not going to say, I'm not a friend, I'm a developer. So, start recognizing that the team needs support, the team needs people to help each other. Testing is a mechanism by which we help to get our job done. So, the fact that some people are specialists or consider themselves professional testers is a good thing. But having testers on your team does not mean that the non-testers don't test. You know, that's, you know, beware of this sort of creating vacuums of responsibility. You know, don't let a tester be the person who takes away your responsibility for doing testing yourself. And a pleasant point is that I'm very big on this idea of why before how. I know it's slightly off the main topic, but I think there are various things that are relevant here. It's interesting that the session before lunch was about focusing on solutions rather than problems. And I thought that's a good way of getting past negative thinking and helping people say, well, you know, how do we just sort of focus on the fact that something is wrong, how we focus on fixing it. That's great. But when it comes to software development, we almost have the opposite problem, is that we need this constant flow of things to fix, things to do. And I often see that people are focusing on solutions without being clear about what is the problem that needs to be solved. So that's why I say one should always understand why before you start talking about how. And one of the situations in which that occurs is you know, our tests themselves, how we express our tests. Now make sure that when we're designing, when we think about a test, start with the expectation. So if you're not already doing these patterns, try them out. So when you're running a unit test, start by thinking, what's my assertion I'm going to do? Think about the thing that's actually needs to be checked should be the first thing you're considering, and then the rest is, okay, how do I get to that point? How do I set up my test in order to be able to make that assertion? From an acceptance testing point of view, it's exactly the same, but just a slightly different terminology. So if you're using a BDT tool like Cucumber, you're going to have given, when, then. I always say, start with the then. What is it that your expectation is going to be? Using a fitness fixture, what will be the output column? What's the thing that you expect to see? And then you can understand what your input's out if you need.
I like this too, Mike. This is AAA, arrange.
Arrange after certain.
Start with a certain. Yes. So the kids in your mind.
Yes. Yeah.
It's easier to start with a certain, actually.
Yeah. I mean, who does this already? Is this a normal thing? Yeah.
Yeah. It depends.
I've written it down on a sticker and posted it next to my monitor, but I haven't.
You haven't got around to doing it yet. And another little bit of advice is that don't forget to name your test in a way that sort of matches the expectation. I think too many tests I see some kind of description or representation of the inputs to the test rather than the outputs. So you'll see things like a registration test, or you'll see a purchase test or something like that. And it hints at what are the action we're taking, but gives no clue as to what the expected result is that test is checking. So a test that says something like, discount for early registration is a better name because it's saying that's what we're expecting. So I always say, when checking your unit test name, take a look at what's actually going on in the assert line and say, is that the theme of that reflected in your test name? You'll get better for the unit test names. Similarly for exceptions tests. And a similar thing applies at the story level. If you're using the sort of fairly common user story format, and as a user or as a stakeholder, I want some change so that some benefit ensues, well, fine, if that's working for you, well and good. But I see a lot of teams where the so that is kind of like this afterthought if it's written at all. It ends up being a fairly trivial rewording of the so that. In other words, the focus is on the rewording of the I want. So people are saying, we'll just make this change, because I want it, okay? A good suggestion that again comes from the BD world is that swap the sequence around. Start with what is the problem that we're trying to solve. And so a nice sentence structure that is, in order to solve this, then I want this. And another thing that I've suggested that I did for a team recently is that rather than the I want, so rather than express it as a single stakeholder wanting something there, I think that works when you're at an early stage building features, but when you're into a stage where you're making minor improvements, minor modifications through a system, it's not always what a user wants, it's an improvement that we can change. It might be something that's only subtly apparent to the user. So instead I phrase it in terms of what the team is proposing. So for a type of user or for a stakeholder, we could do this change. The emphasis too is, of course, a could rather than all we need. It's a proposal. So related to that is the somewhat old advice that you should never presume solution design within your requirement. I think that advice sort of stretches back to the early stages of computer science and still holds true today. So rather than putting the burden, or putting the obligation perhaps upon your product owner to say, well, they should state the problem and they should also state the solution, well, let the solution be something team arrives at. Your technical team is in the best position to come up with alternatives or come up with possibilities for how you solve this problem. So an extreme version is to say, just have the customer write the in order to part. Just state what the problem is to be solved. They might have an idea in mind as to what is a solution, what is a change to solve that. But if you're suffering from the problem of product owners always jumping at a conclusion about the solution that isn't the best, then I would encourage them to defer that part and let the team arrive at the potential solution. Okay, that is the end. Thank you very much. And we've got a couple minutes if you want questions or discussions. Or anything else.
I really found this last part very interesting, especially this change in order too, and separating the solution from the problem, which I often see as a problem that somebody's asking a tiny problem, but he also has a solution, closing the solution space before you really can understand what's going on. I mean, that there might be a better solution.
I think that's really important. Too often we just the problem exists, but we don't spend enough time articulating what that is, and that can prevent us from saying, is this the best solution? Yeah. Is there another way to solve this problem?
Or what I see often is like people describing a problem by not describing the problem, but by asking for a solution. And it's mostly not the solution for the problem. It's a solution for something other, but not the problem. So they have to always dig into this, and I will try this. They can really separate this the customer, so you make it obvious that it's like two different things to do. Because I've seen also a lot of stories which started like as a system I want to use. So it's like, yeah, because it doesn't fit into this world, and it would be better in order to provide this or to do that. It would be much nicer.
But that's a classic thing. I mean, sometimes, yes, that's just a case of the particular template or the structure not suiting, but more often, yeah, when someone says, as the system I want such a thing, it's poor. It's somebody not thinking about what the problem is. Yeah. Because the system doesn't want anything. You know? The system doesn't care. We're not going to lose money because the system's unhappy. You know? You need to find out what is the real problem. You know? If you're convinced there is a solution that we need to put in place, then you need a better stakeholder than the system. All right, I'll say thanks for attending and enjoy the rest of the conference.